The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. If you can make it through a very difficult discussion of gun control, public health, and a stalemate in the Middle East this hour, we've got a real treat for you later. It's the pitch of living. It's the pitch of living. It's living in your head. A look at a very non-traditional Broadway hit, Spring Awakening, for the rock and roll crowd and the silent set. We'll explain it all later this hour. But we begin with hand-wringing, condemnations, and finger-wagging. International issues that seem impervious to change. U.S. policies that seem to tolerate violence and instability in the Middle East. Policies that seem to do nothing to prevent or stop Russia from supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in airstrikes this week that have violated the airspace of NATO member Turkey and inflicted damage on U.S. allied opposition forces.
By taking military action in Syria against moderate group targets, Russia has escalated the civil war, putting further at risk the very political resolution and preservation of Syria's structure of future governance it says it wants. This approach is tantamount to pouring gasoline on the fire of the Syrian civil war.
If what U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says is true, then there's very little in the way of flame retardant in U.S. policy. The Pentagon acknowledged that a Syrian training program has largely failed, a program with a $500 million price tag that promised to train more than 5,000 Syrian fighters within the year, managed to recruit only 4 or 5 Syrians to go after ISIS.
We should expect that there will be occasional setbacks along the way, particularly in the early stages. We also need to keep in mind that we are supporting and enabling this effort, and our partners, not us, are in the lead. It is taking a bit longer to get things done, but it must be this way if we are to achieve lasting and positive effects.
General Lloyd Austin, commander of U.S. Central Command, speaking last month to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. President Obama's mission to end wars is beginning to look like a toleration of violence in the Middle East, slow or tepid support for refugees in Turkey and Jordan, or in welcoming Syrian refugees to the United States. Does Congress have an answer? The White House seems to be missing. Senator Benjamin Cardin is the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee.
In Syria, we need a government that will represent all the people of Syria. In Yemen, we need a government that will represent the people of Yemen. So it's a common theme. We cannot win this militarily, but at times the international presence is critically important for stability. So we need to have a smart use of our military, but understand it's not going to be the way that we win the campaigns in the Middle East.
Well, what would you tell a Syrian refugee about when they can expect this Syrian democracy that might provide stability and allow refugees to come home? And what would you tell a wounded American serviceman who's lost an arm and a couple of legs about the smart use of the U.S. military that we're waiting so much anticipation to see sometime soon?
Well, quite frankly, there's been a different view in among members of Congress, including this senator, on whether we should have used our military or not. Having said that, once we commit our military, we are strongly behind the mission, and we'll do everything we can to make sure that mission is accomplished successfully and with the least risk to the men and women who serve in our military. So U.S. military presence is important, but the way to end the misery is to empower the people to defend themselves and to have a government that reflects the will of all of its people. In Syria, that means President Assad must leave. The sooner, the better for the people of Syria. That we need a government that will represent all of the ethnic communities. Once that's achieved, we think the vacuum that's been created in that country that allows organizations such as ISIS to be able to operate will be much less vulnerable to that type of activity.
Finally, Senator, would you say that the violation of Turkish airspace by Russian jets is a violation of NATO and is a possible confrontation of NATO that would force some sort of NATO confrontation with Russia?
Well, Russia, we could is involved in so many different violations of international law. their what they've done in Ukraine, their activities now in Syria, going with Turkey, their operations in Moldova, in Georgia. You can pick the place that Russia has violated international protocols. The lessons that we've learned is that we don't want to escalate a conflict, but we have to stand strong in opposition to what Russia is doing. And I think the international sanctions that were imposed not only by the United States, but by Europe against Russia for its activities in Ukraine had an impact. And Russia was hurting as a result of those sanctions. So there are ways that we can take actions against Russia without the use of a military confrontation. And we got to be very clear that their illegal activities can never be condoned.
Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
So the Umpqua Community College shooting last week in Roseburg, Oregon, was the 294th mass shooting this year in the United States, according to ShootingTracker.com. Let's just say that Americans love their guns and leave it at that.
I probably own more than 50 firearms. Many of them have increased in value 2, 3, or even 4 times. I sleep very comfortably outside Austin, okay. Texas, knowing Alex. That I can defend my family.
Okay, Alex Jones. This is
Infowars.com.
This is the man who wants to deport me from the country for wanting to get rid of assault
rifles. It's to point out you're a foreigner, a redcoat, here telling us what to do.
Whatever.
Go back to where they took the guns if you don't like it. The communists...
That's radio host Alex Jones going after CNN host Piers Morgan on the CNN show Piers Morgan Tonight in 2013. Morgan is now the U.S. editor-at-large for the London Daily Mail. This week, responding to the Oregon shooting, he said the silence on gun control in America has been horrific and deafening. But is this editor on All Things American being a little naive about the nation he's supposed to be explaining to the folks across the pond?
Look, America is a violent place, but Britain has historically been a very violent place, as has Germany, as has Japan, as has Australia. And the common denominator of all those countries is that through the evolutionary process of their societies, all those countries have in the end renounced guns in the belief that guns actually make a society more violent.
I'll grant you, Australia is a case close to the United States, but how do you think that's replicatable in the U.S.?
Well, the particular problem that America has is that there are over 300 million guns already in circulation. That is, by any yardstick, way higher than any of the countries I've just been talking about in terms of volume of guns currently in society. I speak as somebody that loves America and loves Americans, but having been brought up in a country where there are no guns, the one thing that you're completely struck by when you come to America is the amount of paranoia and fear that infests daily life in almost every sphere of American society because of the presence of guns. And you see the number of massacres that happen. You know, my issue with it is there seems to be a kind of numbness, as the president said, to these things happening. You know, when Australia had 35 people killed in a massacre in Hobart in 1996, they changed all their gun laws irrevocably, and they've not had a mass shooting in Australia for 20 years. So there is an example here to be looked at, and I'd simply urge Americans to look at it and say, is there something we can do, given the large volume of guns already on the streets of America, to try and reduce gun violence? To me, doing nothing is unconscionable.
I think you have a matter of scale here. 300 million guns in a nation that is also the largest arms producer in the world, bar none, by many factors. I mean, yeah. China comes close. How do you get rid of the guns?
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to recognize who is committing most of the mass shootings. They tend to be twisted loners in their late teens, early 20s, perhaps on medication, perhaps with mental health issues, perhaps watching violent video games, violent movies. But all those other things are prevalent in societies like Britain and Germany and so on. So the same issues are prevalent in all those countries. The one thing we don't have is a system in our society that allows these people who are so dysfunctional, who are mentally ill, to get such ready and easy access to guns. And, you know, if, for example, all America did was make it as difficult to buy and own a gun as it is to buy and own a car, then thousands of lives would be saved every year. But for some reason, because it is framed in the Second Amendment, the Bill of Rights, the right to bear arms, it is decided that a gun, which has one purpose, and that is to shoot things, should not be regulated in the same way as a car, which has a primary purpose of getting people from A to B.
But what about the possibility that this country that you love so much actually enjoys guns, actually doesn't really care about the violence as much as you do? And in fact, being a violent country is kind of interested in the possibility that, hey, if I have a gun, I might actually be a hero one of these days by blowing away one of these mass shooters on the Piers Morgan show, for that matter.
Well, if you're happy to live in a country which espouses such a philosophy, then I feel sorry for you. I mean, no advanced country like America, which is a great superpower, which has done so many great things in its society and in the way it goes about its business. Nobody living in America surely would want to have a society which prides itself on being the most violent and making heroes out of mass shooters.
Well, we don't pride ourselves on it. I guess maybe the issue is not so much the gun violence. You know, when I read op-eds like yours, it's always filled with this platitude of this is the America I love that represents so much blah, 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 freedom, blah, 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 democracy, blah, 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 peace. Since 1945, and, you know, let's just not even mention the civilian deaths in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, America doesn't represent that anymore, period.
It doesn't mean, John, that America can't go back to representing that. And the other central point to remember is that America, by comparison to Britain, to Australia, to these other countries I talked about, is a very young and maturing country. And as I say, all those other countries used to be steeped heavily in gun violence. Gun ownership in Britain 200 years ago was just the same as it is in America. Everyone had a gun, but they don't anymore. So there is a way for a society to mature and evolve. Yes, America's violent. Yes, America has problems. I believe there is a far larger constituent of reasonable-minded people, decent Americans, who actually have had enough of this gun violence and are trying to work out a way for people to make effective change and make it safer.
Mm-hmm. If, as you say, there are a significant number of reasonable people who believe, as you do, that they want to do something significant, not something, you know, simply symbolic. Let's see if we hear from them. And if we hear from them, mm-hmm. let's get you back on the show and we'll talk about that. But
sure.
My sense is that we have enough evidence right now that this constituency of reasonable-minded Americans probably doesn't exist.
Well, then you need to walk around with me in a lot of the cities of America I've walked around in, where a lot of Americans come up to me and say, thank you for trying to do something. We wish more people in the American media and more American politicians would get off their backsides and actually try and do something too, because we are sick of the gun carnage on our streets and sick of our children being blown to pieces at school. There have been 142 school shootings since Sandy Hook. If any American wants to ring into your show and with all good conscience say this is something that should not be looked at and somehow arrested, then I would really question their souls, honestly.
Piers Morgan, U.S. Editor-at-Large at the Daily Mail, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Chase from San Diego, California. In my opinion, the argument over whether or not Americans should be able to own guns is irrelevant. The fact is that lots of people have guns, and if someone were to try to attack you or someone you care about with a gun, your only option, self-defense, is to have one also.
This is John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening. Santa Rosa, California adds, Americans have guns because other Americans have guns. I'm all for a gun-free society, but I have a hard time arguing with friends who live in neighborhoods where there is a very real risk of armed home robberies. There are 300 million Americans who have access to guns, over 75% of this nation. And those guns, it seems, aren't going anywhere. Chicago, Illinois. Not only do I think, as Americans, we should be allowed to bear arms, I believe that life is real. Every American should be required to at least be familiar with them so that you understand the danger and the protective value of guns. In doing so, I believe much of the violence would be diminished. Portland, Oregon. I don't want a gun, but I want to have the right to. This country was founded on the notion that we do not have some overlord telling us how to live, so I get the right to bear arms thing.
This is Kareem Johnson calling from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. The foundation of and continuous defense of our nation required us to have the ability to impose our will over our own destiny and circumstances. This generally requires military strength or arms. The Second Amendment gave us the right to protect ourselves, our property, and our individual states by the right to bear arms.
Hi, my name is Harper. Americans should have guns to protect home and property. If someone tried to burglarize your home, you can defend yourself. I keep my gun at home in a safe place. I have never shot my gun before, but will blow a burglar away.
Hi, my name is Maggie Jane, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I say no, why should we? If anyone should carry guns, it's the people who are students and teachers and people who go to church and people walking around in malls to defend and protect themselves against unstable people with guns who come into those places to shoot those people.
Hey, folks, America is a violent place. Period. The end. Romeo, Michigan. Personal protection. Police response time is minutes at best. After, if you have time to call them, even draw time is seconds. Protection from threats, both foreign and domestic. And there are the fearful people who want guns and the happy folks for whom guns are a sport.
This is Barry Waits from New Albany, Mississippi. I do believe that citizens should be able to own guns. In the southern U.S. where I live, hunting is a way of life. I myself am an avid hunter, and I own several guns. I, however, am not a member of the NRA, and I don't agree with their views on gun ownership. I'm all for background checks and waiting periods, doing all that we can to keep guns out of the hands of criminals.
This is Michael Rosen from Ridgewood, New Jersey. We should own guns because the Constitution gives us the right to do so. In that light, I believe every American has the right to own a flintlock weapon. Anything else should be heavily regulated, like owning and driving a vehicle.
Orangeville, California. To protect ourselves from bad people with guns, I'm a 30-year-old Iraq vet, and I keep a pistol at my bedside to protect myself and my girlfriend if a robber or a drug-crazed lunatic kicks in the front door of my apartment. They are within arm's reach from our bed. I have military training and weapons use, but it is the untrained or disrespectful gun owner that I worry about. Minneapolis, Americans should be able to intellectually, maturely handle guns, no matter their size, number, type, or purpose, with articulate emotional self-awareness in order to properly discern adequate safety needs and protocols in times of fear or perceived threat. And Washington State, yes, Americans should own guns for hunting. People enjoy it, and it ties families together. Reasonable people, folks. Unreasonable Americans. This is our country. Let us know what you think about the Second Amendment at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Mama who bore me, mama who gave me.
Back in 2006, the Broadway show Spring Awakening, about the sexual repression of Victorian Europe, with a rock and roll musical score and teen characters that anticipated the ensemble TV hit Glee. In fact, two of those actors made it to Glee. In 2006, Spring Awakening was a Tony-winning revelation. And in 2015, it is once again.
I spent the entire day thinking about your note. Truly, it touched me, it did, that you'd think of me as a friend. Of course, I was saddened to hear that your exams came off rather less well than you'd hoped, and that you will not be promoted come fall. And yet I must say straight away that fleeing to America is hardly the solution. And even if it were, I cannot provide the money you request.
Aha, 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 well, fine, not like it's even worth the time.
In the current revival of Spring Awakening, deaf actors and hearing actors and musicians and dancers combine movement, music, and American Sign Language to tell a story about sexual repression, but also the story of intolerance for people with disabilities. In this case, the deaf, forced by hearing culture of the 1800s to communicate, quote, naturally through lip reading, not sign language. ASL, along with sexual liberation, become weapons in a social revolution in this Broadway musical. The staging is based on the Deaf West Theater production and will continue through January 9th, 2016. Daniel Durant is deaf and plays Moritz Stiefel. His interpreter in our interview is Dylan Guile. Alex Borniello is the stage voice of Daniel's character, singing and speaking his lines in the show. And Ali Stroker plays Anna, the first wheelchair user to make it to Broadway. These actors talk about the thrill of being in a blockbuster show that also makes a statement about the power of theater.
It was amazing to be in a room with people that have to translate in their own way, because that's what I have to do anytime I'm working on a production. I have to constantly translate movement and whatever is happening on stage to work for me and my situation, because I do use a wheelchair. And it was really cool. Like, we were all just adapting, you know, through the entire process.
And you're in a wheelchair, as you just mentioned. It's not as though you don't have something to do already with your hands.
Right.
So
exactly.
How does that work? You've got to use your hands to move. You've got to use your hands to talk. You have a great voice. Going for you. But that's a sort of form of theatrical juggling, I would think.
Yes, it definitely was. At the beginning, when we started doing the sign language with choreography and in the songs, I had to try to figure out what was important, like when could I give a push and then sign, or when was I going to be pushed by someone else and sign. And also, we got to the theater, the Brooks Atkinson on Broadway, and realized that the stage was really old and that there are actually hills within the stage. So all of a sudden, I take my hands off my wheels to sign a line and I'd start rolling away. And so we had to figure out a way to have my other castmates like hold on to my chair so I wouldn't roll away while I was signing a line or something like that.
The character you play, Moritz Stiefel, in the Broadway production, the original Broadway production, was a tragic character but a secondary character. In this production, you make this character almost central to the entire show. Did you have an ambition to make this character something that it wasn't when you began?
I would say I definitely did. I wanted to make sure that Daniel wasn't on stage, but rather that I was really showcasing Moritz and Moritz's story. And I think Moritz's story is central to the story of Spring Awakening. As you said, that character is extremely tragic. And it took me a very long time, and I struggled to embody that tragicness that you speak of and that you experienced in the show. And I think with both my physicality and Alex's voice, that is the character of Moritz, and it's been a really cool experience arriving at that point.
To see how your vocalizations, Alex, communicate, and you have a beautiful voice, and the musicality of the show comes through, but to have this separate channel of the intense physical tragedy, it's like the two of you are greater than the sum of your parts.
You know, I had never met a deaf person before, so in my experience, I had to very quickly learn how to aid Daniel in telling this story and this character's story. And for me, that meant, you know, sitting down with him with a script, him showing me the signs for everything, and me learning how to vocalize what a character's feeling, and, you know, him and I meeting in the middle to decide what the best way to do certain things is, and you know, working together. So that also includes me giving him cues physically. So I'll tap myself certain times so he knows what line of a song we're on, things like that. So that's been my experience of it. So it's been a very strong team effort, especially with me and Daniel.
And then, of course, the show is all about sex.
Sure
right?
is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
And if there's any subject that just, you know, you never hear talked about together, it's disability and sexuality.
Correct. And it's a part of my life and a story that I have been dying to tell. And I think that Spring Awakening just really resonates for me and for probably a lot of young teenagers with disabilities, of feeling like they're not understood and that they're not able to communicate their truth around sexuality. And it's an honor to be able to tell this story and also for this part of our lives to be exposed on stage.
Now, even though the show's about sexuality, you don't get any in this show. But still, that sense of repression is a part of the story of deaf culture in America.
Of course, especially in the scene where we're in the classroom and the teacher is punishing the deaf children for signing in class. But as I've stated before, that's our native language. That's our natural expression of who we are. And in the 1890s, and even still to this day, deaf people are constantly being reprimanded for using their native language, their signed language. And so we do have a long history of oppression.
Best fan experiences after the show?
it's cool. A lot of different kinds of people have come to see the show. And, you know, of course you think, oh, Spring Awakening fans are young teenagers, but that's not really, you know, it's been such a diverse group of people, and it's really neat to meet them afterwards. It's really special.
Especially seeing the deaf community come out to see this show. Completely deaf audience members are getting a chance to see theater on a world stage as
musical theater.
A musical theater, right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's so unique.
And I mean Daniel can speak more to this, but they can feel when a song starts. And you know, they might not understand necessarily what music is, but you feel the rumble of the stage and of the music and the drums and everything happening. I mean,
it's been really extraordinary experience getting to meet with the fans after the show. And like Allie said, we have a very diverse audience, and that's been wonderful to see. And some fans have never seen American Sign Language before, or never met a deaf person before, and the show inspires them to go home and learn some signs and come back to the show again and show off that they've learned a few things in American Sign Language. It's such an honor to be in a production that has that kind of value.
Daniel Durant plays Moritz Stiefel in Spring Awakening. His interpreter during our interview was Dylan Guile. Alex Boniello is the stage voice of Daniel's character, and Ali Stroker plays Anna in Spring Awakening, the first wheelchair user to ever make it to Broadway. Americans and Guns, take away listeners and guns.
This is Laura of Pompano Beach, Florida. I think one of the issues here is the news. I think they over-sensationalize the gun issue, making people feel unsafe. If we would start with the news and having them, you know, to give people what the real risk is, because we do not need that many guns. People do not need to defend themselves like they think they do.
You can give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.